I listen to the diaries because it sparks ideas for new adventures. Whether it is an episode about an epic adventure or a backyard micro-adventure, I start thinking about my next adventure. I'm inspired by the people and their stories to go a little farther and dig a little deeper. If you want to add more spark to your adventurous ideas, consider subscribing to the Diaries Plus today. I'm Crystal, a longtime listener from the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina.
Thanks to everyone who has subscribed to the Diaries Plus. It's been awesome, and you're powering the show as we move into the future. If you're interested in subscribing today, there's a link in the show notes. Please join. Now, on to the show. Hello, hello. It's Fitz. So, I think we all have moments in our year that pull us through time. Maybe it's the opening day at Ski Hill or the summer solstice. Like, I love that day. What a great day. It's light forever. You do all these things. It's incredible. And it makes me feel the passing of time. 16 years ago, I found a new annual ritual that in many ways marked the beginning and the end of my creative year. I was invited to the Five Point Film Festival, and it changed the course of my career. In Carbondale, Colorado, I found mentorship and friendship, and it got to the stage where I grew confident enough to become quiet, listen, and then encourage others. Every year, this community of creatives comes together for this moment. Some years, it would leave me asking, how do I get better at the pursuit of storytelling? In other years, I left knowing that I was on the right path. Each year, I'd return a little bit different, a little bit changed, and I will always be grateful for that experience. After a few years, 13 years ago, to be exact, Five Point came to me and Becca with an idea. Could we do a live recording from the festival? We'd never done it before. And it was something that we'd go on to do for many years. Maybe you remember those broadcasts. Guess what? After a few years off, we're back. We gathered on a rainy Saturday afternoon at the El Dorado in downtown Carbondale to sit down and share stories. We've got a great show for you today. I'm Fitz Cahal. This is the Dirtbag Diaries, live from Five Point Film Festival. Enjoy. Oh, and a quick note, this maybe is not our best live recording ever, so you might want to listen to this one in a quieter space. Thanks.
All right, John, I think everyone is really excited to hear from you today. For those, you know, I don't want to ruin the, this will be broadcast live. So if you haven't seen John's movie, I don't want to ruin any of it, but I'm going to give you the broad strokes of John. If you were not able to catch Symphony of Lights this morning at this morning's Changemakers program, it is incredible. I felt deep emotions watching it. It was super cool. So in 1971, there are two oil tankers in the San Francisco Bay, the Arizona Standard and the Oregon Standard, they collided, and they spilled 800,000 gallons of oil into the wetlands in the Bay areas. It laid waste to birds, it laid waste to fish, and John was in his 20s, and he witnessed it firsthand. He was involved in the cleanup, trying to rescue some of those birds, and this moment, it would change the course of his life. John made a commitment to the planet. First and foremost, he decided to stop using motor vehicles. And then a few months later, he decided that he would go one step further. He would take a vow of silence. And that's a pretty profound commitment. And that vow lasted for 17 years as John walked across the country. And he walked the roads, he walked the trails, into the beating heart of the green spaces. And during that time, while he was walking, while he was taking this vow of silence, he got his undergraduate degree in Oregon, and then he walked to the University of Montana and got his master's degree, and then he walked to Madison, Wisconsin, where he went to the University of Washington, or University of Wisconsin, to get his PhD, studying the basically oil spill responses and doing that kind of work in his education. Ultimately, It was in 1990 on Earth Day. After 17 years, you broke that vow of silence. And I just think that you have epitomized that phrase, less talk, more rock. You know, like, I don't know how to put it there. You're like, it's just, you've done so much with your life. And I think one of the fascinating things about it is that you've done so many things, but what I think really caught people's attention was ultimately what you didn't do for 17 years, was that you took that vow. And that's a pretty powerful thing, because that so much often we recognize people for what they do, not for what they're not doing. So welcome, John. Thank you for being here. All of us are excited to listen and hear a little bit more, and dive a little bit deeper.
Thanks very much for that introduction, and thank you for all being here. Those are the first words I said after 17 years of not speaking. And for 17 years, I had been listening and receiving messages from all of you and from the trees and the rivers and the spaces that are around us. And so it's just very special to be here today. Thank you all for coming to hear me speak and be part of this podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. John, I want to go back in time. You're 27 years old. That's a time in life when people often are finding the person they're going to spend their life with. They're accelerating in their career. They're doing all those things. It's a point when we think, like, maybe your voice would be the most, or speaking, or would be the most important moment. You take this vow of silence. Do you remember the exact moment? Was it a very sudden decision, or was it something that came to you over a course of a few weeks or months? Bring us back to that moment.
Yeah, I think the moment for me was, it began when I listened to the Beatles. And you know that song, Number Nine, Number Nine, Number Nine? That's three number nines. And that's 27. And I was turning 27. So that meant I had to do something really special for this birthday. Also, besides listening to the Beatles, now this was 1973, I had read The Hobbit. And this sounds like, come on, this is your decision to not speak for 17 years? Well, it was my birthday. It was going to be my birthday. And if you know anything about hobbits, you know that on birthdays, they don't expect to give gifts. They give gifts on their birthday, which I thought was a pretty neat kind of way to be, giving a gift on your birthday. I was going to give the gift of my silence to my community on my birthday, because I talk so much. I talk so much. And so when the day came for me not to speak, and it was only going to be one day, I didn't speak. And my community rejoiced. John's not speaking. Oh, you know, they were singing happy birthday. During that day of silence, I would listen just enough to think I knew what someone was going to say. And then I would stop listening and start thinking about what I was going to say back to them based on what I thought they were going to say, to show them that I had the right answer. They had the wrong answer. And in fact, if it was something that I believed that they were saying was just what I believed, I'd be thinking about saying, I could say that better. And so that first day of not speaking, I realized that I was not able to hear anything new without criticizing it, without not believing it. And so I realized also that if I couldn't hear anything new or different than what I already believed, then I probably have stopped learning. And it was a very joyful time and a very sad time. The sadness was that, oh my gosh, I had missed all this opportunity to learn from all the people around me and some of them that were no longer there. The joyful part of that was that I could listen now. I could learn. I could learn more. And so I decided I would do this another day. That was it. But I decided to do it another day. This went over the one day that I had given myself to be quiet. And the next day came and I decided I'd do this another day. A week went by and I was still learning. I said, I'm learning so much about myself and about people. Oh, this is great. At this point, my community was starting to get worried. They said, you know, First John gives up riding in cars. And now he's not talking. When's he going to start talking again? And they would ask me, John, when are you going to start talking again? And I realized I didn't know. I was asking myself the same question because I had never been to this place before. And so I thought and I thought, and another week went by, and I thought and I thought more, and another week went by, and finally I said to myself, I'm going to not speak for 1 year. And at the end of that year, on my birthday, I'll ask myself if I should start speaking again. But after that year, it came up to my birthday, and I was so into listening, I decided that I would spend the next year in silence. And it wasn't until 17 years later that I got to start speaking again. My mother was sitting in an audience. It was on Earth Day, the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. I chose Earth Day to speak because I wanted to remind myself in the years to come that I wanted to speak for the environment. And the environment for me had changed from being just about pollution and oil spills and loss of species and habitat. The environment changed from that. Still important. All those things were still important. You gotta save the forest. But if people were part of the environment, and I got that from my education, at my formal education, and then from my informal education and just being on the road and walking, and how we treated each other was like our first opportunity to treat the environment in a sustainable way, or even figure out what we mean by sustainability. And so environment for me became about human rights and civil rights and gender equality and economic equity and all the ways that we relate as human beings to each other. If we oppressed one another, it was going to manifest in the physical environment around us. If we exploited each other, it was going to manifest in the physical environment around us. And I hadn't heard that. And so after 17 years of not speaking, I thought I had something to say. And that's why I started speaking again. And that's why I thank everyone there for being. That's why I thank you for being here. Because after 17 years of walking across America, listening, studying, walking, formal education, informal education, I believe this was something important to say. Kindness is the magic sauce. Kindness is what got me from one side of the country walking across to the other side of the country. And I think kindness can actually change the world. And it's not just my kindness. It's all of our kindness, all of us being kind. And it's not so difficult to imagine what kindness is. I think we know. We can feel it.
You know, the other day I was reading, there's 40 different muscles, like little fine muscles up in this part of our, in our cheeks and around our eyes, so that they can convey this deep range of human emotion. And in that, those years, it seems like you sort of developed a system of sign language. You learned all these ways. You know, humans also want to be seen and heard. And I was curious, like, did you ever feel loneliness at all? Because maybe, you know, you were doing so much listening. Like, did the loneliness creep in of maybe not being able to fully have people understand what might be going on in your head, or that search for something to say?
Yeah. That's a great question. And yeah, I would get lonely. And at the same time that I would get lonely, there was a part of me that wanted to be alone. And that part of me that wanted to be alone would often get lonely. So there was a part of me that loved walking in wilderness areas and the mountains and being by rivers and listening to the conversations of the trees and the rivers. You know, we want to be that person to find out who we are, but we also want to share that person with each other, because we are a species that, there's a word for it, that we are, that we're social. We are social beings. And so even in our solitude, there's also a part of us that wishes to be part of all of us and to be the social beings that we are. So, yeah, I had to deal with that.
You know, throughout your life, I think you would have broken any pedometer that you ever wore. billions of steps, right, that you've taken in that past and in that course of walking. And you've moved around. You've walked on different continents. You even repeated your journey across the country later on in life. And I'm curious, for a person that's moving all the time like that, and obviously there are points where you're a little more settled, but like, what do you say when someone asks you where you're from or where your home is? Is what happened to your concept of home?
Yeah, I still have a concept of home where I was born. I was born in Philadelphia. And as a young child, I went to school in Philadelphia, but I spent my summers in Cape May, New Jersey, and that's in our family home there. So when someone asks me where I'm from, I usually say, well, where I'm from right now is from Cape May, New Jersey. And so that's where I'm from. However, when people say, God, don't you miss California? I don't, because I'm in California so often that it's sometimes people don't even realize I left. And people would ask me and say, well, John, how could you leave California where you live for New Jersey? You know, it's not to diss New Jersey, but, and I'd have to say, you don't know Cape May. Well, specifically, you don't know West Cape May, because that's where the migratory bird refuge is. And it's probably number one or number two. It goes back and forth as for birders. And you ask a birder, do you know Cape May, New Jersey? And they go, oh, yeah. That's where I saw that.
There's a moment in the, and you mentioned it briefly, there's a moment in the movie where this light bulb goes off in your head and you start looking for the green spaces on the map. You know, on your journey, you've kind of been walking along roads and all of a sudden you're just like, wow, I can walk on trails. I can, you know, find those sort of dark green spots on the map, and they're going to be more rewarding. And you know, there's a lot of terms for that. It's like nature bathing, or, you know, exploring, or being outside, whatever we want to call it. But what happened to your heart and your mind when you immersed yourself in the natural world? A lot of time out there.
Yeah, I think for me, being silent in the natural world and being on foot, except when I was on a rowboat, sailboat.
You were on a rowboat?
Walking in the water. It's very deep. So that's the other person that can do that. Boats, you know, boats, wilderness, ocean, wilderness. But just being there to listen, to receive, and not only listening with your ears, I think maybe as we go on for speaking today, which we're talking about hearing with your ears because you're not speaking and hearing, and you hear the conversations of the river and the streams and the trees and the wind and all those things. I think that we forget the part of how we hear with our hearts, and because we're like these beings that have this field around us, and our fields communicate, our fields mingle and touch each other. So there's this invisible field that touches all of us, that we're all connected, and particularly to the earth and to the planet.
It's funny, sometimes in the world of asking questions, there's a trick you can use. And sometimes if you're in an interview where you just slow down and you actually don't say anything, and the person you're interviewing will kind of be like, what's going on here? And they're uncomfortable, they'll fill the space. And they fill it in incredible ways, and maybe in ways that your question wouldn't have done it. And I don't, that would be really awkward to do all the time, but occasionally it's something, it's a little tactic that I can use, right? And I'm curious, in that setting, do you think people gave more of themselves, like more than just a fleeting exchange, because they knew you were listening, and they knew that sort of auditory space between two people, it likes to be filled on some level?
Well, I think people came, you know, sought me out, particularly in our village where we lived. People sought me out just to say things to me, because they said, well, we know you're not going to repeat this, John. I really need to tell you this. And they would tell me something. And they were right, I wouldn't repeat it. It would just be, I was a kind of a ceremony. I was just part of a ceremony of being with people and what had to be said in that way.
Yeah. I remember, my boys are in the audience over here, and I remember before Becca and I had our kids, we were, you know, intimidated by it, and we're trying to figure out how to sort of put some parameters on being parents. We're pretty organized people, and you know, like blah, blah, blah. Of course, we kind of really figured out pretty quickly that we shouldn't set too many rules for the future selves, because like the future selves might be like, we don't like those rules. But it's we went through that process, and I think we kind of set a framework for how we would be as a family. And I think when we came down to it, we were like, oh, there's only one rule, and we're not always gonna live up to that, but there's one goal, one rule, and it's to be kind. And I felt like when we talked it through, everything else sort of seemed to fall into place about how we care for each other as a family, how we care for our community, and we weren't gonna sweat the rest. It was like, that was the thing. And that has been a huge part of walking, and that point that, you know, when you found, you're like, I finally sort of discovered something that no one else has said, and that statement, like, how long did that take to evolve, that understanding of kindness being the magic sauce?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that it evolved over time, and not that, you know, John has the corner on kindness. Wow! No, I don't think so. I think it's, you know, it's been around for a long time. And I've just finished writing this children's book on kindness. And it goes back to It's called Human Kindness, True Stories of Compassion and Generosity That Changed the World. And so a friend of mine who was a publisher, he said, John, would you write a book on kindness? And it was right during the pandemic. And I thought, wow, yeah, of course I'll write a book on kindness. And so every day for the pandemic, I mean, it was like I would get up and I'd think about kindness. And I go, what a gift that my friend Chris gave me to just gave me permission to think about it. And as I thought about it, I did research, you know, as I had a PhD, so I could do research now. And I was emeritus at the University of Wisconsin on their Board of Visitors. Now I was emeritus, and I could use the library, and they would send me, I would look online, they would send me whatever book I wanted, and with little self-mailers to mail them back when I was finished. And so I just got all these books on kindness and expressions of kindness, and I realized in my research, when I say research, because that's a PhD kind of a thing to say, and I realized that kindness went back way before people kept, you know, records in history. So it was pre-recorded history before that time.
Talk to me about that. What were you seeing when you did the research?
It was found in, you know, a lot of digs and ancestral places where there's evidence that someone was born with very debilitating diseases that crippled their limbs and made it impossible for them to go out and hunt and gather. But they lived to be, you know, 20 or 30 years old, which was very old for that. And there was evidence then that someone cared for them. Someone thought so much about them that they did all that stuff for them. So there was evidence that kindness existed before we even are talking here today about it. So way back before people wrote things down. In Africa, there's evidence that when people were born with debilitating diseases or they had some kind of infirmity, that they would just make that part of the community and give them some special ceremony. They would take care of them, but give them some kind of special ceremony that they would only they could do. And so it wasn't as if they were just taking care of them, that they were also being useful for the community. And so there is just this history of kindness and compassion that goes back since the beginning. And I just feel that now that we're talking about it, that we are seeing the expression of it in our words and in our actions, that it's something that can really be developed, that we can practice and we can work on. And as you practice, you know, you go, oh God, I wasn't very kind that time. There's this other thing. When I wake up in the morning, there's three things I have to meditate on. One is gratitude, because we're here, I'm here. The other is love, because that's so wonderful that we get to share that with each other. And then the other is forgiveness, because if we can't forgive each other, we get stuck. We can't forgive ourselves. I like that Timmy came out and says, okay, give everybody, give themselves a hug too. That counts. Yeah. If you can't forgive ourselves, you're not going to be able to forgive others. And we need to forgive each other because we have to go on. We have to go on and take the next step and the next step and the next step. And when we bump into each other and make, you know, what they call those? Boo-boos? Yeah, it's a boo-boo, Dad. When we have these boo-boos that we, as human beings, tend to make for each other, we have to forgive each other in order to go to the next place. Okay, yeah, we did that. We acknowledge it. Let's go on.
John, how old are you right now?
Right now, I am 78 years old.
And you said you have one big last walk in mind. Will you tell us about that?
Yes, I started this walk. Well, I guess I should go back to after I walked the length of South America. My fiance, at the time, we've been dating for 10 years. She said, I'm on my way to Africa. She said, John, wait. Don't you think we should get married and have kids? I said, oh yeah, that's right, we should. So we did. We got married. We had, you know, two boys, and they're 23 and 17 now. And the 17-year-old goes to a boarding school and is very self-aware and kind of knows what he's at. I'm still allowing myself 2 months to go and walk and have to come back and make sure that we're together and I am not neglecting him. But he'll be in college probably next year, and I will spend more time walking in Africa. And I'm working with the GLOBE program, which is globe.gov, and you can look that up. It's a program, it's environmental education, gathering data, scientific data, climate data, that kids do from K to 12. And they gather this data, and then they send it to NASA, and NASA puts it on a GIS map, and that's shared all around the world. The rainfall, the cloud cover, the soil moisture, mosquito habitats, and things like that. It started off here in the United States with a few hundred schools, and that was in 1994. And now it has, I think, 127 countries with about 50,000 schools around the world. And so kindness, as part of my work with the GLOBE program, is whether we're gathering data, scientific data, the hard sciences, but we're also looking at how does kindness fit into that? And is there some way to measure, you know, or quantify or qualify acts of kindness for students so that, you know, we grow up, you know, with kindness, thinking about it, and not only thinking about it, but practicing it and looking for it and promoting it and all the work that we do, so that when we do go into space, that we are taking and thinking about kindness with us.
John Francis, everyone.
After the break, we talk with Renan Osterk and Taylor Rees. Stay with us. Support for the Diaries comes from Ketone IQ. As I've been getting more and more into longer runs and bike rides, I found myself fighting with my mind. As the miles extend, I feel like my reactions get slower and I make more mistakes, like tripping or falling, or just kind of feeling slightly out of sync descending on the bike. On those big days, I've been using Ketone IQ to help my brain keep fueled and sharp. I want to have fun, not bonk. Here's the science. Ketones already exist in your body. When you push up against your boundaries, your body begins to convert stored fat into ketones, which your brain prefers consuming. With Ketone IQ, I feed my brain so my muscles can use the glucose I get from whatever else I eat on the trail. Riders of the Tour de France have been taking the same approach. I am definitely not as fast, but I can apply the same thinking. Give it a try. You save 30% off your first subscription order at ketone.com/dirtbagdiaries. Once again, that's ketone.com/dirtbagdiaries. The link is in the show notes. Please check it out. Support comes from Kuat Racks. The Piston SR is a single rail bike rack that easily mounts on most roof racks, overlanding utility racks, and truck bed rack systems. The dual ratcheting piston arm grabs your tires and makes no contact with the bike frame. So that's better for your bike, right? Plus, the rack has an all-metal construction, genuine Kashima coat, and integrated cable locks. That translates to being super burly. Kuat has taken their Piston Pro X and elevated it. Find more details at kuat.com. Kuat, because you will absolutely love this rack.
So our next two guests are Taylor Reese and Renan Osterk. And, you know, in the last 15 years, their creative lights have shone as bright as anyone's through art, through photography, through storytelling, through filmmaking. They've been able to combine, I think, adventure and a pursuit for technical excellence in sort of filmmaking and photography in ways that few people can, but even more importantly, I'd say that few people are willing to do. You guys just go to the ends of the earth and to the ends of yourselves, it seems like. And sometimes seems like it takes a pound of flesh out of you, sometimes. But it's pretty incredible. You just had your new film, The Polar Passage, just premiered here at Five Point. I want to zoom out a little bit today and sort of talk about a bunch of different things. When I think of you guys, I think of this incredible duality, where on one hand, you both are arguably at some of like the best at bearing witness to the human spirit, right? Of like exists inside of us and our potential for personal exploration of those limits and exploration of the world. And then I think you also, on the flip side of it, you aren't afraid to look at the hard parts of humanity too, which is also part of the human spirit. Like we tend to think of the human spirit as a good thing, but the reality is that there's an edge to it. And you are willing to look at that unflinchingly through your work. So I wanted to kind of jump into that. So I'll start here. I'm sort of terrified to ask this, but how many different time zones have you guys been in the last 2 months?
I just got back from this crazy, crazy documentary thing that was 6 countries in 5 weeks, so I'm definitely a little all over the place. But, so yeah.
That makes my head hurt.
Might say some funny things.
You know, if there was a thread through your work, I would say that it's difficult things, right? And kind of like, that's how I sort of define what you all are interested in. You know, whether that's how two humans might exist in a giant landscape as specks in it, you know, where you're really, you know, wandering through a jungle or wandering through a great mountain range, like the Innerruth Gorge. There also, you've been documenting these sort of uneasy conversations about how we have a species, we've moved into this next chapter of our history and our planet, and there's a lot at stake right now. Taylor, you know, your Instagram, I think your headline for it is, "I'm here for the animals." And I think that says a lot. You've been working in wildlife conservation recently, and in particular, you've just been spending time with the two last white rhinos on the planet. And I think it's worth letting that sink in, because we all know enough about biology that that's not really solvent anymore. You know, as two left, you're like, that's kind of the end. Will you tell me about that work?
Yeah, John, when you were talking about different ways of listening, I thought about these two rhinos that I've been spending time with. They're the last two living northern white rhinos on the planet. The population has been decimated by poaching, mostly. We've essentially killed off many species. And when I got into this project, I was asked by National Geographic to direct a film about this effort that scientists are using IVF to try to bring the species back from the brink of extinction. And at first I was like, oh, this is so Frankenstein. This is so human of us to grasp at this loss when we should be mourning, when we should be recognizing what we've lost. And we're like, no, we can fix it. And we can use technology and we'll somehow, you know, get out of this in this way. And I was very wary of the project, but I went to Kenya and I spent time with these rhinos. And one day, Amy Vitale, who's the photographer that I work with there, she and I laid down in the grass with these two females, Najin and Fatu. And the rhinos actually communicate subsonically through the ground. So they create vibrations with their heart and their lungs and their vocal cords that you can barely hear. They're lower than the human ear can hear, but they send vibrations through the ground, and that's how they communicate with each other. And we laid on the ground, and I had so much you know, just it's so incredibly sad when you really think about what it's like to lose species every day. And yet, you know, we can't really take this despair with us all the time. Like, it has to move somewhere. We have to do something with it. We have to be kind and to continue on and to try. And so Amy and I were laying there on the ground, and we were trying to hear what the rhinos were communicating. And we ended up just breathing, everything relaxed. And I could hear them, and I could just hear how unbelievably calm they were as they're walking themselves into extinction, as they're, you know, taking only a number of breaths more before this is over. And there is something just bigger, something that's just like, you know, there's bigger cycles going on. And maybe in this moment in time, we are going to lose a number of species on our planet. And maybe humans are going to get through this, or maybe we're not. And I think to take a step back and just really appreciate what we have right now, that actually helped me to really start to understand what these scientists are doing. And in fact, like, this effort to provide reproductive support to species who are, you know, only have a few members left is actually incredibly important. And the southern white rhino was brought back from just a couple of breeding pairs to 10,000 individuals. And there are some ethical questions as to, like, how much we should be meddling in some ways, but we've meddled our way here. And if we can help species, monkeys, Sumatran tigers, leatherback turtles, northern white rhinos, especially keystone species, which really keep ecosystems intact, then I think it's super important to make an effort to do so. So kind of come full circle into being pro Frankenstein on this particular project.
Yeah, for you, do you think the storytelling is an antidote to some of that heartbreak? Because, like, obviously that was a big emotion right there, and thank you for sharing that. But, like, do you think part of that covering it and the documenting it is part of how we're going to process this, and maybe how you process it too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think storytelling is just this ancient thing we have. And another way to look at it, I think, is just exchanging information. You know, systems are healthiest when they're exchanging information. Us as individuals are healthiest when we know the most about ourselves, when we're absorbing from each other, when we're exchanging. So this shutting down of the human consciousness to great losses that are happening in the world right now, like, that's just a lost opportunity. Like, we are experiencing great loss. There's species and human beings are suffering tremendously as a result of a lot of the privileges that we have ourselves. And it's easy to be like, oh, wow, that's really complicated, and I don't want to look at that. But I think through storytelling that can give us opportunities to feel and to learn, that don't shut us down, that aren't based in blame or shame. Yeah, you know, just a way to connect to what we're all a part of is healing for me, at least. It helps me process.
Renan, you know, the your new film, Polar Passage, just premiered, and you are one of the best at kind of working in really just environments that aren't comfortable, or to most humans. Maybe you're like, I'm right at home here, but, you know, in the Polar Passage, you basically take a sailboat, your team's going through, and you make it through the open water passage that's now opened up on the north side of North America. It was 4 months in a boat with a bunch of other people. How, like, what does that actually look like? Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like the day-to-day of that, is that, are there moments of boredom, or how ready were you to get off that boat? And, you know, I think, right, you've also struggled with seasickness too. I mean, that's rough, right? Like, how do you work through that? How do you stay creative? How do you stay, like, a kind, thoughtful person to the people you work with and that you're documenting, and how do you find the energy to keep giving that to your subjects in a situation like that?
You know, I was trying to relate it to the stuff that John was saying as well, but yeah, it's the Northwest Passage, or the boat left from Maine, it went to Greenland, up the Greenlandic coast, and then through all the little passages, Baffin Island, Northern Canada, and all the way out to Alaska. Eventually, Taylor was there for the Greenlandic coast section, and we had some members coming in and out. There were some, like, complicated little things that happened. Yeah, it's, at some points, there were a lot of people on the boat, and it was kind of more of a party boat, and you're sailing through the coast of Greenland and you're looking at some of the most incredible mountains you've ever seen every day, catching Arctic char, doing polar plunges, stopping in these incredible little Greenlandic towns, and feels like the memories are just coming and it's just rich. But then there are the crossings where everyone goes away and you only have four people on the boat, and you always have to have someone on watch. So you have 6 hours of sleep and then you have a 2 hour watch, and that cycles through, and sometimes your watch is middle of the day, sometimes it's middle of the night, but it doesn't get dark. So over the course of 4 months, your sleep cycle's never normal. So, and that does strange things to you, but especially the one crossing that I remember like really specifically was going from Greenland to Baffin Island across Baffin Bay, and you have these moments where you're just alone up on deck in the silence, and it's a small fiberglass boat, and you have to watch for ice because it's just like a day, like any little thing could be really, really bad, because yeah, you're not going to really get a rescue, and you're looking out and there's just lack of humanity, and it just makes the world that can feel really small feel really big again, and yeah, it allows you to quiet down and feel something different. And that's what I like about doing these challenging expeditions, is it forces you to think in different ways and be kind in ways that you haven't been before. And that's what we're learning more and more in all of our productions, is that sometimes trying to push people in your crew is really hard and it doesn't work. But yeah. And if you lead stress first on all these things, whether it's a commercial job or a documentary job, it's kind of going to implode. You have to lead with joy. And but yeah, it was hard to keep the joy sometimes day after day. And there's as a creative person looking for visual things, you're on the boat, and sometimes it's just days and days of the same angles. And there's nothing you can really. There's nothing left to shoot at a certain point.
I hadn't even thought of that. Like, that would be like, how do I make this boat look better than I did the day before? Yeah, that's funny. That must have felt sort of like pushing the boulder up the hill to have it roll back down instead of a bit. So much of it in our world, or like in the creative space, is you the urgent. Things are urgent a lot of times. And it's like, I need a response now. I need this right now. This film needs to get made right now, because if we don't do this, it won't. Like, it won't be there. And I think you guys have often taken a really different tact of patience. And I think it's led you to get some incredible projects, because you viewed something of not that I have to make this in a season, or not that I have to make this in 2 weeks, but that I'm going to make this over years. And, you know, you guys have been working on the issue of lithium mining and, you know, how that's unfolded. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about that project and about how that patience has allowed that project to evolve into something you probably never even imagined it would be in the beginning.
Yeah, I feel like all my friends who are in the audience, I hear you're going to finish this film. I feel like I come to Five Point every year and talk about the same thing. But yeah, a number of years ago, back in 2017, you know, the whole idea of electric vehicles being a solution to climate change was really booming. I got an opportunity to shoot for Tesla, and I was like, oh, that's so cool. And just was, I don't know, started asking the question of where this lithium was coming from. I ended up connecting with a handful of community members from the Lhkhanantay indigenous communities in Chile and Argentina, who invited me down to kind of support them with a film. And getting down there and seeing that, and I mean, there's hard rock lithium mining, which takes place in China, in Australia, a little bit in the United States. One of the biggest sources of lithium mining on planet Earth right now is groundwater lithium mining, which in this area in Chile, Argentina, and Bolivia, they're essentially mining the water from underneath the surface, bringing it to the surface and evaporating it and then scraping the minerals out. So they're kind of draining these entire aquifers in one of the most incredible places on Earth. Like, the oldest living bacteria that have ever been found are found in here, like these extremophiles, and they're the ancestors of all life. The Lhkhanantay people have been living intact culturally with the ecosystems for 12,000 years, one of the oldest, you know, indigenous civilizations that is still functioning, still evolving, still there. And with these mines, There's probably 15 to 20 years left for that culture. You know, people are not going to fall over dead, but with no water, there's no animals, there's no wanakas, there's no llamas, there's no, you know, and the food systems and everything kind of crumbles. So initially I went thinking like, okay, you know, we're going to make this film about the big bag mines and our horrific misunderstanding of the green future, which involves these sacrifice zones, these people we don't want to acknowledge, like we'll just essentially have to die or be lost like in our beautiful green future. And we're going to do this and we're going to get the mines shut down. You know, it's so simple. It's like us versus the mines. And so I went down there initially, and that was kind of the initial narrative. There were protests in the street, people laying their bodies in the street to try to stop these mines. And then I, like, something kind of stuck with me, like, well, I don't know if I can like quite edit this. I'm going to go back in 6 months. And I went back in 6 months, and things were evolving and deepening. And I went back 6 months later and 6 months later. And I've been going back twice, two, three times a year for the last 6 years now. And every time I go, something like really radical happens. There was 1 year I went back, and the main character, my friend Jorge, who was leading these protests, like picked me up in an electric car and was like, we gotta talk. You know, I've been working for the mines now, and actually this is my way of seeing self-determination for myself and my community. And so now, okay, the film's growing. Now we need to look at this in a bigger way, that it's not just anti-mining. It's actually how do people in general adapt when large-scale extractive projects come in, especially when you're a people who've been colonized or there's not a, you know, supportive government in place. And so then I thought that was the story. And okay, so now it's, you know, we got multiple ways of surviving, and some people are anti-mining and others are pro-mining. And aren't we all kind of in that situation? Like, some of us are like, technology will save us, and others are like, no, we should go off-grid and return to the earth. And I was like, okay, that's the story. Like, I've got it. But I'll just go back one more time. And there were protests in the street against some of my main characters now being accused of embezzling money. And just like, things were getting super complicated. And ultimately now, because this story is collaborative, it's not like I'm some objective journalist going down and being like, what do I see? Like, we're making it together. I've just extended an invitation to the community to say, what do we want to say together? You know, this is, how can we listen and learn from what you, the Lekanantai people, have to say about like what these final years mean, if they really are the end of the culture. And the story that they're putting forth that we're trying to create is about these big cycles of loss, and that, you know, we are coming into the end of a cycle where there is great loss, both in this particular region and globally. And how do we mourn that, and how do we honor it, and how do we move through it, and knowing that like there will be new growth and new change. And I don't quite have it all figured out, obviously. I can barely talk about it, but we're getting close. And yeah, that's funny.
It seems like you're close. I feel like you can talk about it.
I'm hopeful.
You know, the one final question for you guys. You guys see a lot, you witness a lot. Can you each think of one frame that you saw unfold? Or maybe it's a scene, maybe it's a moment, maybe it's even a single image on a still camera. But in the last year, can you think of one magical moment you've captured?
I don't know, that's a hard question. I think I was in Chile and Argentina in January, and one group of the community actually left the village in order to not be corrupted or take any of the mining money, and they've kind of set off to try to basically maintain their cultural practices for as long as possible and move kind of my up into the hills. And or like building a well and making it work. And we just had a great time telling jokes and trying to make pancakes. I don't know, just it's the simple things really. Just to be able to do these kind of projects, but where the foundation is friendship and connection, and you're there as a part of it. And you know, we're human beings getting to interact with each other in from different parts of the world and learn from each other. That's the joy for me, for sure.
Well, everyone, Taylor and Ron, thank you so much for joining us up here. Let's give you a round of applause. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Woo! Thanks to John, Taylor, and Renan for sitting down with us. We put a link to the trailer to John's film, A Symphony of Tiny Lights, in the show notes. Check it out. Thanks to Charlie Turnbull and Luis Yolanis for inviting us back to the festival and organizing all the details to put on this event. It's so appreciated. Music today from Bradley Carter, Jacob Bain, and Nice Cotto composed our theme song. This episode was edited and mixed by Evan Phillips. Illustration by Walker Cahal. Becca Cahal is our executive producer. I'm Fitz Cahal, and you've been listening to The Dirtbag Diaries. Thanks for tuning in.